Hello and welcome to the Asian Cinema Film Club. I'm your host as always, Edward Johnson. Joining me, of course, is my co-host, the Professor, Mr. Stephen Palmer.
Hello!
And welcome to what is likely to be the last of our recaps of Asian Horror Month. Due to the timing and there being a weird month, I think that we're going to end up with like three films that we don't cover. So all the rest of this what we've been watching will be going on to incorporating into our roundup on episode 120, which will be also a special episode because we're going to have a episode of Listener Roulette. So that's going to be exciting to see what the listeners have got chosen for us. This time listener Marcus has picked something out, so it's going to be exciting to see what that is. And combining with your pick of the King Comedy, Stephen.
A double episode of joy and fun.
That's what we hope for on every show.
I nearly gave it away because I know what the Marcus's pick is, and I nearly gave another clue, but shut me up.
So, yeah, been a little bit of another weird week, to say the least. Obviously, if you follow any of our socials, you will be able to see exactly what we've been watching at the various points. We're on Facebook, we're on Instagram, and we're on Threads, and we're also on Blue Sky as well. So last time, if I'm remembering right, we rounded off with Goku Body Snatcher from Hell.
I think you're correct.
So that was day 19, which brings us to day 20. So for day 20, the pick was The Snake Girl and the Silver-Haired Witch, which is a film which I've been wanting to watch for a while, but it kind of like put off for whatever reason. But this one's directed by Noriaku Yusawa, who is a mainstay of the Gamera Showa era, where he directed 8 films in the series. So he's basically what Honda is to the Godzilla Showa era. He is to Gamera Showa era. And it's really, with this film, he gets a chance to show that he can do something other than like kaiju movies, and presents a film that's really sort of like heavy on style and mood. The film itself, follows this girl called Shairu, who has spent most of her life living in a boarding school for orphans, until one day she's collected by a real father. Now, returning to her family home, where her mother is in this state of constant absent-mindedness, as we're told she suffered a head injury, and the father is called away with his work. He works with like snakes and venomous creatures, and it basically just leaves her in the home with her absent-minded mother. And it's also at this point that she discovers she's got a secret sister who lives in the attic and also might be part snake. Have you seen this one, Stephen?
I've not only seen it, mate, I reviewed it for Eastern Kicks.
Did you?
I did.
What did you think of this? Because I thought it was really great until the ending, which gets a little Scooby-Doo.
My review says, a wonderful little curio of a movie from deep in the DIA archives. Yeah, I seem to remember it being not quite a film of two halves, but always like two films. It was weird. So as you say, there's this whole sort of, is her sister a part snake, part girl creature sort of horror movie that's all kind of creepy and reminds you of something like The Reptile or something like that, literally.
Yeah.
And then, well, then the Silver-Haired Witch stuff happens, and it almost feels like it's in a different film. But I remember, and I've got it, I actually went out and bought it after reviewing it. That's how much I liked it. So yeah, I really enjoyed it. You know, like 8 out of 10, 4 out of 5, that kind of thing. Is it something I'm going to throw at anybody? No, because it's a bit, I did feel the sort of the last act belongs to a different film.
It is a bit weird. I think if the Simpsons Treehouse of Horror hadn't done the episode where Bart's evil twin Hugo is kept in the attic, then I would have probably been able to, I would have viewed this one a little differently. I mean, I love that it's got a lot of style to it, and it's got some really trippy dream sequences. We have these great moments where we see Shairu being spied on for these eye holes that are like carved into the ceiling, and the actual mystery part of it's really good. It's just a shame it gets a little Scooby-Doo towards the end.
Yeah, I mean, it's got some interesting background stuff. So it's based on a manga by the same guy, well, a couple of manga, Kazuo Umezu, who did the manga of Drifting Classroom, which would be filmed by Obayashi, the guy who did House.
Okay, yeah.
So there's this whole kind of... all these sort of films are kind of connected to each other. And, you know, and it kind of shows you that manga was a fertile ground for adaptation, even back then. Yeah, some of her dreams and stuff do feel a bit like House, doesn't it? Or House Sue, doesn't it? But it's obviously a lot earlier and a lot less trippy. But I remember now, I was just reading through my review live. Obviously, I think it's pretty obvious I'm a bit of a comic book fan, but I'm also a bit of a fan of sort of the British weekly comic books from the like the 70s and 80s. And there was a girl's comic book called Misty. I think I might have said this when I talked about this in a past episode, actually. But it feels like a comic strip from Misty. Misty was like a girl's comic book, but all the stories had a horror-based tinge to them. This is the kind of weird shit we used to do in the 70s in the UK. We had 2000 AD was merely the end point of all these weekly comics. You know, we had war comics. The famous one was Action, of course, which famously got banned. But yeah, Misty and Tammy. I can't remember what Tammy was about. And there was one that was all science fiction stories. Eagle. But yes, anyway. Well, Eagle kind of predates all that. That's like from the 50s. But yeah, Misty, there are some collections now, and they're fantastic. And I don't know why they were only aimed at girls. Mostly because girls are the protagonists. And, you know, girls can only read comics about girls, can't they? And boys can only read comics about boys. This was the 70s, sir. Anyway, it just feels like that kind of sort of 70s horror kind of thing, I know, or if it was a film, it'd be like an Amicus movie or something like that. That's what it feels like to me.
Next up, we had Horrors of Malformed Men, which brings us on to our first jaunt into the Uroguro genre, which came before the Pinky Violence genre. And it's a genre that blends erotic imagery with the grotesque, with the master of the subgenre being Turo Ishii, who directed this film. And it's a bizarro tale of a medical student with no memories of his past, but for no explainable reason finds himself with memories of a mysterious island. Now, having escaped the asylum he finds himself in at the opening of the film, he soon finds himself drawn into an increasingly complex web of lies as he takes the identity of a man who's recently died and looks identical to him, right down to the bizarre mark on his foot. And he ends up traveling to this island, which has been this obsession for him all this time. And it's here that he finds the web-fingered, weirdy-beardy leader that's been building his own community on the island, transforming his followers into hideous freaks. And, you know, for all the nudity and gory imagery here, there's a really engaging story at the heart of the film. But at the same time, it's one that really is sort of like layered in some really sort of surreal imagery that recalls like Jodorowsky's El Topo, but that didn't really come out until the following year. And at the same time, there's also like elements of like the Island of Dr. Maru sort of like wrapped up in it. It's just obviously a lot more psychedelic.
So I have to confess, I've never seen this.
Ah.
But the reason why I've never seen it is I'm pretty hardened to horror movies. I don't really let them bother me too much. But just the title of this one freaks me out. So, you know, I am the king of buying Arrow Japanese movies, and I haven't. I don't know why. This one's just scary. But actually, now you've given it the when you were describing it, my mind went, this sounds like the Island of Dr. Moreau, which is absolutely sort of a rich source, isn't it, of lots of sort of horror stories and things like that. So I'm kind of thinking maybe I should go and watch it.
Well, it's on the Arrow Player, so you can watch it easily. And I think it's also on Amazon Prime at the moment. There's a bunch of tales that have just recently gone onto Amazon Prime, such as Hiroko the Goblins on there. And I think there's some other Fred Winter film stuff on there as well.
Yeah, so. You're right. It's there to rent and buy.
Oh, I thought it would be there just to rent on Prime, but no. Ishii's got some other fun titles in his back catalogue, such as Shogun's Joy of Torture, Orgies of Edo, Inferno of Torture.
Orgies of Edo, I've watched. So I think they must. I think Arrow released a whole bunch of them at the same time, didn't they?
Because Orgies of Edo is the first in that six film series that includes Yakuza lore. And Shogun sadism. I'm not a huge fan of like torture movies, so I'm not sure how quickly I'm going to rush off to watch them. Although I have seen Female Yakuza Tale, which apparently is part of that same one as well.
I'm with you. I don't really like torture movies, and when that whole Eli Roth led torture porn. Sort of thing, you know. I forget what the names of the movies were. I hated them all.
Oh, like Hostel.
Yeah, exactly. I just don't. Even though Hostel did have a cameo by Takashi Miike, I just found them all soulless and dreadful and mean. So yeah, it probably wouldn't appeal to me either.
Next up was a rewatch because I needed something quick to catch up because, you know, I took a vacation in the midst of all this for like one day. And that was Tetsuo the Iron Man, which is a film I constantly find myself like coming back and forth to over the course of these. Every couple of years, it's sort of like it's one of those films I come back to, and it's certainly an interesting debut for sure. I mean, it's a breezy 67 minutes, but at the same time, it feels that there's a lot more going on there than that runtime would have you lead to believe it's there. But as we covered on the show when we did Tetsuo the Iron Man and Tetsuo 2 Body Hammer, it's such an influential film when you look at it because he obviously takes inspiration from Western cyberpunk and then ended up creating his own subgenre of Japanese cyberpunk and the Western sending a new creating a new genre in the West of like Western filmmakers who were influenced by his films. And it was also part of that whole sort of era of visceral horror, such as like Evil Dead Trap and Best City. And this, as I said, there's just something about this tale, this salaryman who finds his body becoming this nightmarish blend of flesh and steel that just really keeps me coming back to it. Even though it's a grimy and sweaty movie, there's something about this film that I keep coming back to it for some bizarre reason, and I'm not sure why.
Yeah, I mean, we've obviously covered it before. It has got this glorious sort of visual style to it, even though it's clearly been made on a tiny little budget, even for a tiny little budget films go. What I will use this as an excuse to cycle back to our last episode where you said you'd watched Haruka the Goblin by Shinya Sakamoto.
Yes.
So I have caught up and I've watched Haruka the Goblin now. So if we just Scooby-Doo it back to then, I watched that today.
Okay.
I think you enjoyed Haruka the Goblin, didn't you?
Yeah. It was surprising because all the... You know, all the promotional stills of it looked like it was like really intense. It kind of looked more like it was, do you know the cult that they have in Body Hammer, where they're all like hanging around the industrial state, and that's what it kind of looked like in all the stills because it shows like all the underground footage at the end. And then when you watch Hiroko the Goblin, you realize it's something actually completely
different.
Yeah,
so I hadn't realized it was like a studio film, so it was like his first studio film, and it's really frowned upon by Sakamoto fans, saying, "Oh, it's not as good as all his deep, dark, psychological body horror weirdness that he does elsewhere. But I looked at it, I mean, I think you sort of mentioned about how he's taken his inspiration from the West and how the West have taken inspiration from him. It felt like here's a film where he called up Sam Raimi and John Carpenter and said, I'm just going to nick some of your ideas. Is that all right, lads? And they said, yeah. And John Carpenter said, yeah, have some music as well. Because it's like Evil Dead meets The Thing by the way of House. It's not my favourite film ever, but it was very entertaining and quite funny at times. And yeah, it wasn't tonally the sort of film I was expecting at all. It's very interesting that Third Window Films have picked it up and they're kind of giving it a re-evaluation. We'll get old Tom Mez on the commentary chat, obviously, because he wrote the book for them, didn't he, about...
Yeah, he did Iron Man, the films of Shinji Tsukamoto, and he did Agitator, the films of Takashi Miike. But Third Window Films are big champions of Tsukamoto's work.
Oh, they
are.
And I've got a couple of his short films on a Third Window's film. You know, I have a strange relationship with Tsukamoto. He's just not my favourite at all. Apart from a couple of his films I freaking adore. It's really weird. I've mentioned thousands of times I love Kotoko, which is a bit of a deep cut really, but I got that from Third Window Films, so thankfully one of the boutique labels is pushing his films. But yeah, Sirica the Goblin was a lot of fun, and Tetsuro the Iron Man, you know, as we said before when we covered it, I really like that as well. It's the Japanese Eraserhead. I know that's a really easy look, there's two films that are done on a budget in black and white, but they both, I don't know, they've got that same sort of grimy feel to them.
Yeah, definitely so. And it's interesting, as you mentioned, when he goes on to do like Hiroko the Goblin, like a studio movie, and at the same time, because he's so young, he's not really respected by his crew. He falls out with one of his actors, and I think he even ended up getting into a physical confrontation. The filming of Hiroko went a month over schedule and ended up with crew working on the film essentially for free. But at the same time, when you look at that film and you see like the stop motion sequences in there, or you have people's heads like randomly disappearing, there's all these weird, fun little moments in it. Combined with the fact that he's got this real, it's like, I think I often say it's like Ghostbusters meets Evil Dead, because you have that unseen evil of the Evil Dead, and then you obviously have demon team. So, but yeah, the stuff is fun bits in it and dark caves.
It definitely
felt
like it was really inspired by Western 80s horror movies with the whole Japanese folklore stuff in there as well. It was really interesting. I don't know why people are so down on it. But that's people for you, isn't it?
Indeed. Next up, we had another recommendation, which was Angel Dust, which is a psychological thriller by Gakuyuki Ishii, who takes a break from making cyberpunk and punk movies. He did like Punk Samurai, and he did Best City. Here he presents a film which has the absolutely gorgeous Keiho Minami, who's half Japanese, half Korean, and spends a lot of time in various states of undress, and has people like comment how beautiful she is, such as the opening scene where she's in a deprivation tank and the woman at the center says, "Are you a model?" And it's like, okay, we get it. She's pretty, you don't need to like constantly tell us. But she's got one of those, she's sort of like a trait, you do like that double take. It's kind of like the lead actor of Lesson of Evil, where he could be like a part-time model if he wasn't acting.
She's in The Great Yokai War.
She is.
Yeah, I haven't seen this. You have sent me the link to
I have seen you the link because it's on Rare Film, because I don't think there's an actual release out for it. So it's on Rare Film, and everything on Rare Film, until it actually gets a proper release, they keep up on there, and then they delete as soon as it gets a release, which is it's a fair way of doing things. But here she plays a forensic psychologist attempting to stop a serial killer preying on former cult members in Tokyo, which also sees having to reconnect with her former boyfriend and disgraced psychologist Dr. Aku, who's been responsible for breaking people out of like brainwashing, but his techniques are sort of like been very sort of frowned upon because they're sort of very fringe. The poster for the film actually proclaims this as being the best thriller since The Usual Suspects, and everything else I was trying to think of, like, oh, because I felt it was like more closer in tone to Seven than Usual Suspects, but Seven didn't come out until the following year, so that makes it a bit tricky to sort of compare it to that. And this would make for a really interesting double feature with Cure, especially as it's got a unique killer, and there's certainly some really fun, unique twists along the way, including this relationship that she has with her former boyfriend. And I look forward to revisiting this one again, because it's got a kind of a long runtime, because it's clocks in around 2 hours, and when you're trying to watch this sort of thing in the chaotic school holidays, you sometimes miss some of the details. But I would recommend checking this one out. It's very sort of stylish, and especially with like psychological thrillers, it's definitely a good one to check out.
Yeah, it does actually look my cup of tea, so I will definitely check it out.
Of course, if that seems a little highbrow, you can always look at our next selection, which was Tokyo Gore Police. This one is directed by Yoshiro Nishimura, who is known as the Tom Savini of Japan, because he is a special effects maestro as well as a director of note. And this basically sees him building on his short film Atomica Extinction, which we've talked about previously on the show. But here the police have now been formed a military unit to battle the creations of the mad scientist Keyman, who's got a virus that mutates people into living weapons called engineers. And this is also a film which challenges Takashi Miike's Dead or Alive for having the most bonkers opening ever, as this one features a chainsaw duel, self-mutilation, mutants, we have an exploding head as well, and there's just lashings of ultra violence to top all this off. And this, as I said, this is all within the opening 10 minutes of this film, so it sort of like throws it down like what you can expect, as this is a film which certainly lives up to its title, because we've obviously looked at some colourful titles along the way here, such as, you know, like Gothic Leader Battle Bear and Bloody Chainsaw Girl, and this one I think certainly lives up to the title. But at the same time, I mean, it's very similar to, like, you know, the John Wick movies, The Light Comes for Us. You get it kind of like exhausted by this onslaught of violence and splatter, even though there is a strong storyline to keep it together. And certainly Nishimura is definitely a talented director as well as a special effects wizard, as both are very much on display here, with most of the effects being done with practical effects, but also that sort of outlandish sort of practical effects that you saw with like the Machine Girl and Meatball Machine. It's that sort of like bizarre psycho violence that that we got with that sort of Tsuchi Typhoon wave.
Absolutely, I have seen this as well, long time ago, that I watched it because Sheena, who is the girl from Audition, is in it. And she's not in many films, but she's in some of these movies. She's in this one. But I think I must watch it back in the day, because I was trying to see what else she was in. But yeah, I've already expressed my love for this kind of movie. It's just bonkers, high concept, Japanese. Yeah, I don't really know how to describe it. It's a popcorn muncher. It's daft, it's silly, and it's got sexy Japanese women kicking ass in it. What more do you want?
Pretty much. I mean, the fact Nishimura says he doesn't watch television at all, and he's actually a fan of Dali and the sort of surrealist painters, with a lot of his inspiration coming from his dreams, which makes me really wonder, what sort of dreams is this man having? Does he eat a lot of cheese?
Well, what happens when he falls asleep, yes.
There's the sergeant character in this has like a pet, which is basically someone in a bondage suit with no arms and legs that later turns up with knives for arms and legs. So yeah, it's certainly something.
Enjoyable nonsense, that's all I'm gonna say.
Yeah. Which should also be said about our next film, which is Nobuhiko Obayashi's House. Which is that legendary oddball haunted house movie, which somehow started as a Jaws remake for Toho, but along the way became what this film is. And it also featured him getting inspiration from his daughter, who provided many of the film's ideas. But I think one of the film's greatest achievements here is how it manages to go from being a technicolored fantasy complete with sparkle-eyed cats to an Evil Dead-style nightmare where the girls finding themselves under attack from the various spirits which inhabit the house, including one girl memorably being eaten by a piano. This is still a thrillingly bonkers film. Even though I've seen this multiple times, it's still an absolute thrill every time I watch this. And I think the fact that Obayashi's films are now getting more release, again, Third Window Films are ones bringing them across. So I'm looking forward to finally getting to watch some more of those. So,
and we've done this on the show, right? Have we done? We've never done House. Oh, my word. Well, credit to you for not calling it Houseu, which is second only to calling Ringu, what winds me up. Everyone calls it Houseu, and that's just how Japanese people say English words. Oh my god, this is a fucking I fucking love this film because it's just so bonkers and crazy. And when I remember when I first saw it, I couldn't believe what I was seeing. And I've seen some nutty stuff before, and like you said, there's this. It's got moments of horror. You know, some girl gets her fingers chopped off, and then, like you say, a girl gets eaten. But then there's the crazy stuff where someone gets eaten by a piano, and what's the thing that happens with the watermelon? Not a flying watermelon, knock somebody down a well or something like that. I'm there's just so many things, and I've got the as you know, I've got the soundtrack on vinyl, but I now own a record player, which I didn't when I bought it. Oh, just a marvellous movie. But I really do like most things that Obayashi's done. And so, again, it's really cool that Third Window Films, you're right, there does seem to be another director that they're backing, although they've barely touched it. But, yeah, I think The Drifting Classroom, is that what it's called? Yes, is another favourite of mine from him as well. So yeah, I can't believe we haven't done that as a show. What's wrong with us?
I think it's been put on the vote a couple of times, but I think everyone voted for other things.
We're all idiots. But you're all idiots. Vote for House next time.
is this your turn to say something?
That's right. I'll be the bad man today at Elwood. Yeah.
Next up we had Grateful Dead, which has is kind of like in many ways like a twist on Amelie, as it has this girl called Nami, who's got a unique hobby of spending her time watching the oddballs of society, who she calls solitarians, and she takes great delight in watching the unusual interactions with the general public. So basically, you know, those oddballs that you find in your local town center, this is her, the people that she likes to watch. And she basically likes to follow them on the lonely lives that they often lead, and her latest obsession being this old man. But when the local church interferes with her plans by providing him companionship and hence stopping him being from lonely, it soon sends her on a bloody rampage. This is a film that feels, again, like two films sort of sandwiched together, with the first off, as I said, it's got that sort of Amelie sort of set up. It's very sort of quirky, where she's shows where she's like her family home life, where her mother cares more about sending money to you know, orphan children in Africa than her own children, and her father's obsessed with her mother and constantly just makes her these omelets that she doesn't actually really care for, but it's sort of like her thing. So when the mother disappears off, it sends the father into sort of depression, and her only sort of the only thing that she really cares about is this TV shopping channel, which when she grows up, she receives this this large sort of sum of money, so she doesn't have to work and spends all her time just, you know, ordering things off the home shopping network and spying on people. But as I said, the second half of this film is just really weird. It sort of descends into this weird sort of like torture porn, but at the same time, it sort of comes out of nowhere. So it makes it a real sort of jarring sort of like jump, and because especially because it doesn't really sort of explain itself too much. So I was curious to know if I'd actually missed something during this like initial watch, and hopefully when I rewatch it again, it will make a bit more sense then. But until then, it sort of like leaves the second half feeling rather frustrating, to say the least.
So I haven't seen this. This is another Third Windows one, isn't it? I recognise the title and the picture and the director, I.G. Uchida. He's a kind of fascinating character. So he's actually born in Brazil, but he is Japanese. You know, like, the second most number of Japanese people in the world are in Brazil, because they all moved out there for the, like, a load of them moved out there for the car manufacturing industry. So it's like the second,
right.
Yeah, the second largest number of Japanese in the world outside Japan is Brazil, which is why Japan often get invited to play in South American football tournaments. But anyway, enough of that. But yeah, he was born in Brazil, came back to Japan at the age of 10, worked for Playboy, worked under Takashi Kitano, and then is really, I would say, probably one of the major voices in what's left of Japanese indie cinema. So I think you've seen Love and Other Cults. I'm sure you have.
Yeah, I've seen Love and Other Cults. That was another odd one.
I mean, so this and that are the two that I think have definitely come over. But he's been very prolific. I'm almost certain, I think Love, he might have done one called Love for Sale, which I think was one of those. Do you remember a few directors did the sort of try to recreate the Pinku movies, the Katsu love movies? I'm sure Love for Sale was one of them a few years ago. But yeah, I just a film I've never got round to watching, even though I do love the I love the Third Window cover. Maybe I'll get to it. I don't know.
Okay, so that's where we are at the moment. As I said, we're going to be wrapping it up on our upcoming episode. So our next episode we've got coming out will obviously be our Halloween special, which was Dark Water, where we're going to be joined by Rashmi. And the episode after, we will be wrapping up our Halloween season, because otherwise it's just a bit tricky to get it all recorded in time because of the way these months have fallen. So you'll be able to find out the last films if you don't obviously follow us on socials, which obviously please do, because we have some fun discussions, especially on our Facebook group. We have a fun little cult forming over there. So you can obviously follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Threads. And Blue Sky.
you're the only person I know that's pushing Blue Sky, but keep it up, mate.
If I don't push it, then, you know, if you're lucky enough to have a Blue Sky, because we're only lucky because they said we got hooked up by Emily from her critique. So. But wherever you do in the meantime, you can help us the most by hitting that like or subscribe button and leave us a review, especially on iTunes. That really helps the algorithm, because they love podcasts with reviews. So let us know what you think of the show. That would be really great to hear. So, but until next time, thank you as always for listening. Thanks to my co-host.
It's a pleasure as ever.
And join us for our Halloween special, where we'll be looking at Dark Water, and that will be coming up in the next few days. So, but until then, good night.